Hey, welcome to the Protectors Podcast. Excellent guest today. Probably like episode 410. I don't even know. But it's great to have Mike Cirelli on, and we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of things. And I'm excited for this one. Mike, welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is great, man. You just got back from your expedition, the 776 now.
Yeah. You know, funny enough, people thought we weren't going to be able to do it in 7 days. So I think some of us thought we weren't going to do it in 7 days. And then to do 7 continents, 7 skydives in 6 days, 6 hours and 6 minutes was huge. So yeah, I could not be more proud of the guys, and we definitely won as a team.
Now, how did the fundraising go? Was that pretty cool? And can people still fundraise for it?
People can still fundraise by going to 777.givesmart.com. That's the word triple, the number 7.givesmart.com. Fundraising is, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of donor fatigue, as people know, especially for veteran causes, because there's so many damn veteran service organizations out there. A lot of them doing good work, some ineffective, but donor fatigue. And then as we get further from the war, you know, just naturally it's harder to fundraise for those vets that need help or for the kids of the fallen.
I understand that completely. One thing is I just started a nonprofit for like the protector community into the police. So it's more geared towards training and gear and equipment and stuff like that. But it's like, how do you raise money anymore? You got to kind of look at the corporate donors as well. And then getting to the right person, you know, you have the marketing departments who aren't really connected to the financial officer types who are like cutting a check. So it's pretty tough getting the money out there, man.
And especially for that community that needs it. I've got a good buddy who's a Navy SEAL, Andrew Sullivan. Of course, we call him Sully. We have something called Blue Forces Strategies that's fundraising to help pay for him to go in a team of former JSOC guys to go train police officers. But,
yeah,
you know, it's still equally important to serve these communities. It's just, you know, if you're not in the limelight, people forget about you. And when it comes to fundraising, it comes to relationships, it's better to be best known rather than be the best. It's all about who you know and who you can get into to make donations.
And that's one thing we're going to talk about a little bit later on is like the networking. And network isn't just for raising money. A lot of it's for building your own personal brand. You have to get out there, you know, yeah. And you and I were talking about transition before we hit record. But that's a big thing, man, is transition, you know, coming out of the service, you getting out of the service in 2018 and kind of grasping this corporate culture must have been a real culture shock for you.
You know, the culture between, and I'm preaching to the choir here, the military and the private sector, the civilian populace, is we put a precedence on a number of principles or values or attributes. You know, most notably is in the military, we put we in front of me and conformity to a degree. The civilian populace is, you know, puts more of a precedence on individualism and self-identity or self-brand, where our past, we, you know, our brand was the United States Marine Corps or, you know, Recon Marine or U.S. Army, or more specifically, you know, paratrooper. And when you get out, it feels slimy. It feels disgusting, but you no longer can promote that brand. You've got to build your own personal brand. And again, for, you know, the quiet professionals, it just feels evil in a way, disgusting, dirty. And I realized this yesterday or last week, I'm sorry. So in late January, you know, me and the boys went on Fox and Friends at the completion of the 777. And I was so proud to have all those guys and watch them and just their faces and the sense of accomplishment as a team. And then I was back in New York for Fox and Friends for the book, The Everyday Warrior, by myself. And my wife's like, oh my God, the book hit number 84. I'm like, yeah. And she's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I finally realized I would rather be here with a team of guys celebrating a victory together than me sitting by myself celebrating me, because it just didn't feel right. And I told her, I'm like, I don't like it. And this is why most of the books I write are with other, you know, Brothers in Arms. This one was, it had some contributors, but this one was my book, and I've learned my lesson. I'll never do that again.
The corporate culture, man, it's different. It is so different. You know, when we get into the military, like me, I tell everybody, yeah, I'm a veteran. It's part of my identity. It'll always be part of my identity. Like now when I'm going to retire as an LEO, it'd be like, oh, I was an LEO. But in a corporate culture, man, the more I talk to the people that are actually in it, and especially the ones who came from the military sector and they get into it, like you can go in there for 3 or 4 years, you can leave for another job, and they're like, oh, okay, well, good luck on your next career.
Yeah.
And there's no identity anymore. It's like, okay, no. You're just going from job to job and nobody really cares. There's no team.
And that, I think that is, who am I to say? Our private sector has been wildly successful. I would say culture isn't the healthiest within the corporate world, but there lacks a concept known as shared adversity that we know so well within first responders and soldiers, that you go through hardship together, both mentally and physically. And it creates and forges these bonds, the sense of homecoming and belonging, as the Marine Corps says, esprit de corps. And you just don't find that in the corporate world. And so it's hard to really find a tribe. And I do feel for people on that one of not knowing who your tribe is, when in the military, it's part of your DNA. You know exactly who your tribe is. And then unfortunately, when you leave the military, it's like losing a part of yourself in the greatest support network that ever existed. And that's why I think a lot of us struggle when we get out and return to the civilian populace, is there's no sense of we, just me.
And you've done a lot of keynote speaking with the corporate culture and within that community to kind of show them and kind of give them a guide point on how to get that corporate culture where people want to stay past the 2 to 3 to 5 years. Because, you know, as we know, like in every job or every facility, everything, everywhere, military, civilian, law enforcement, it's a hemorrhaging employees. And they're looking for that grass is always greener. And if you give them that sense of team, that feeling that they're part of something, you give them that kind of like, you know, that embrace a suck type mentality. Like you do something where it really is like, oh, you know what? Wow, we went through this together. I want to stay here. And now I know the people I'm working with, my right and left. So that's pretty cool that you're doing that. And what is that? What's your concept with that? Are you like going to big corporations, little ones?
So, you know, across the spectrum from Fortune 500 to small to medium businesses to federal government and even religious groups. And really what I focus on are three things: talent, hence the book, The Talent War, which was our first book, How Special Operations and Great Organizations Win on Talent, which really touches on the talent acquisition, talent management side, but really focus on talent, leadership, and culture. And I try to reframe what they think about military leadership. Because if no one served in the military, their preconceived notions come from the same place that probably recruited you and I to go in, which is called Hollywood. And mm-hmm. You're like, oh my God, I want to be with those guys going through hardship. I want that so badly. And so Hollywood is the greatest recruiting tool for the military. And a lot of them have these bad notions that you just bark orders and people like run off and execute your will. And we both know that's not the way it happens. That often the officer, the platoon commander, the troop commander, task unit commander, battalion commander does not mean they are the smartest person in the organization, usually far from it. And if you say something stupid that puts lives at risk, you will get in the military, you will get put in your place really quickly and people will not execute those orders. Competencies knows no rank, as we say. But one of the things I talk about that people totally get wrong is, one, with leadership, you know, it's such a vague art and requires constant reassessment, that, you know, how you led as a squad leader is wildly different than how you would lead as a troop commander. Things have to evolve and things have to change and you have to reflect. Another thing is, you know, they don't understand it, but the military per capita produces more leaders than the private sector. Why? Because it's a series of sequential events, from coaching and mentoring to training to experiential events, that are training these people to become the leaders they are. Leaders aren't forged in combat. Leaders are forged on the training field before they even see combat. People don't, and you know this one, people don't rise to the occasion, they fall to their level of training. And you know, additionally, transformational leadership is the dominant style of leadership within the military, where you turn the willing, the compliant into the willing. People want to follow you for who you are and what you stand for, that you inspire and influence people to action. You're charismatic. That's what people don't understand. And then lastly, in the military, we lead through love. And, that's sort of everyone sort of takes a step back on that one. When I say love, the highest form of compassion or love is accountability. When you think about it, when your child does something wrong, you step in and explain to your child what they did, why it was wrong, what they should learn from it, help them reflect on it, critical thinking to become competent, good human beings that contribute to society and can stand on their own two feet. And then lastly, let me say this, vulnerability, that gets them as well. They don't expect that to come from the mouth of a military member, but I talk about how vulnerability, is highly displayed during the after action review process, and where people can openly, willingly admit their mistakes without fear of, reprisal. And when I work with Fortune 500s and I ask how readily they can admit a mistake in their organization, they all laugh and they usually say they'd put a bullseye on your back. Well, I said in the military, we have a way of putting that bullseye to your front and say, everyone, hey, I entered a room on the first floor and something went wrong. Could have been a catastrophic failure. I want you all to know I did a one-man room entry, didn't receive a squeeze or confirm that somebody was behind me to back me up and potentially could have probably engaged an unknown, which was a woman that looked like she was armed, but in fact, she was not armed. And everyone's admitting their mistakes. Everyone is helping everyone learn from your mistakes as well as your successes. And it's such a beautiful process that the private sector just hasn't figured out yet.
That's one thing I miss about the military is peer reviews. Some people hate them. I love them. I'm like, I want to know how I can improve on myself after actions. I want to know how we could, what we should sustain and what we should improve. Because if you just keep going status quo, I went to, I worked for DHS for a bit. And, back in 2011, I was working at his policy. We're working on policy. We're working on a lot of different things. And we had an excellent site. We can go with, when you're working on something, you pull it out. It tells you who's got it. You push it back in. It's timely. You're on track. You got on track. Now I went to work for DHS last year and it went back to the old email system where everything is like a big email chain. You're losing information all over the place. So if you don't have these after action reviews and you don't have continuous improvement, you're going to fall back to the very, very lowest common denominator because it comes back to staff. At the end of the day, it comes back to the rotation of staff. You're losing a lot of that memory. So you don't know how to do it the right way. If that makes any sense.
It does. And what people lose sight of is that, leadership development is really a daily activity. And a lot of people just don't know how to coach and mentor. I think the Army has three forms of learning or leadership development. Professional development is one, institutional learning. That's like somebody going to, the infantry officer course to learn how to be an infantry person. That's always required to teach people how to do their jobs, like a police academy or any technical skill. Second is on the job training, which you and I know is where the true coaching and mentorship takes place, especially if you have a great leader demonstrating what to do, setting the example through, behavioral modeling or observational learning. And then lastly, sort of on your, self-learning, self-development. But, what I've seen is the best organizations, which when I say best organizations with regards to producing leaders, they take an extremely steady and disciplined approach where every day is approached with the same core principles. And then no single setback is seen as too dramatic and no single success is seen as too important. And what's amazing is when you're successful, you still hold that after action review, discuss what went right, how you do more of that. But more importantly, there's always something, even during successful operations, that you can learn something that you need to do better. And that's what professionals do. And I love the fact when I talk about after action reviews, and I've heard people in the business world say, hey, Mike, that's great. In the military, you have the time. In the private sector, we don't. And I tell them how, we operated off of 4 hours on a bad night, 6 hours on a good night of sleep for 4 months straight, trying to run missions every night. And even though we would get back at 6 a.m., 7 a.m., 8 a.m. in the morning, dehydrated, having just been in a firefight, hungry, guys would reload their mags, put their radios on the chargers. Maybe they'd go get a quick plate to bring into the team room. And if it required 2 hours, even though we were exhausted, that's how long it took to do the after action review. because even if we were successful, we may have seen the enemy doing something in our competition that needed to be discussed immediately, and SOPs or TTPs needed to be adapted in order to thwart that threat and make sure that all our guys came home on the next night's mission. That's what professionals do. And I could not be more proud. And just if organizations could take the AAR debrief, whatever you want to call it, 5 minutes, all your respective leaders leading their subordinates, take 5 minutes and just simply ask, hey, what was planned today? What went well? More importantly, what did we do poorly that needs to be fixed starting tomorrow? You'd see the individual and organizational development skyrocket across the board.
You mentioned a really cool word right there, competition. A lot of people don't look at the enemy as competition. And when you transform that into the business world and you tell them, hey, look, when you're doing these after action reviews, you're looking at how are you going to be able to be better than your competition? It's not just a, hey, we messed up here, but how are we going to be better in the competition? And is there something out there that we could do better to get ahead?
You know, at the end of the day, what really matters is that the aggregate level of performance is higher than your competition in war or in any industry. For you, you know, if it was, you know, Homeland Security or Border Patrol, it's that you guys have a higher level of performance than the cartel sneaking people across or bringing drugs across. And how you ensure that is that you continually train your people. Again, people don't rise to the occasion, they fall to their level of training. So the training never stops. And when you increase the individual performance of each person within your team, the collective bar is raised. And that's how you do it. And it's not easy. It takes time. You may spend years training somebody, making them as good as they can be. And then all of a sudden, guess what? They leave your organization. They leave the Army. They leave Border Patrol. They leave a Fortune 500. And as difficult as that is, that's just life. I mean, Henry Ford, you remember the old quote, sitting in a board meeting, they were suffering from, efficiency and bad labor. And somebody said, hey, what do we do? Hey, we need to train our people. Somebody said, well, if we train our people and they leave, what do we do? And Henry Ford said, well, what if we train them? What if we don't train them and they stay? And that's the thing. And you know, when we wrote this, the talent war was more on the collective level of performance. This right here was on the individual level. The reason we wrote it, I wrote it with the contributors and why Men's Journal approached us to start this initiative is when we would give the speech on the talent war in leadership and culture on, again, an organizational level, like clockwork, every time people come up and they're like, hey, dude, I love these concepts. I'm a father. I'm a mother. How do I integrate them into my personal life? And I'm like, okay. I need to address both the individual and the collective performance. And again, you know, if you're sharpening your blade as a leader within the corporate world, whether you realize it or not, you're sharpening the blade as a father, a mother, community member, whatever it may be. And so that's why, you know, the Everyday Warrior is much more of an individual approach to building those foundational habits that lead to success down the road. Not an easier life. That's the thing. Even a warrior mindset, a positive mindset, does not insulate you from hardship, but it does prepare you to respond or react in a healthy and positive way to obstacles. And that's the difference between a victim and a warrior.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, the everyday warrior. That was my next thing is about, you know, okay, you've looked at everything at the macro level, now down to the individual level. You know, you have the corporate culture, but we have everyday individuals who want to be a warrior. And now a warrior isn't always about, hey, you know, I'll grab a gun, let's go this and go shoot up some stuff like that. A warrior mentality, it can be accomplished in everyday life to get you that next level. So let's talk about that. And do you have the book out there? It's out there. People can pick it up on Amazon and everywhere else, but let's talk about the everyday warrior.
You know, there's a line from Bruce Lee that I love. A warrior is an average man with laser-like focus. An average man or woman. And you're absolutely right. People don't get, I do in the book talk about warriors versus warfighters. They aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but just because you're a warfighter trained in the art of war or how to use a gun does not make you a warrior. I talk about how I've met single moms of two that are sacrificing and grinding, sacrificing their needs for the good of their kids to provide them a better life, that are more of a warrior than some of the men and women I served with on active duty. being a warrior is about a mindset. And I want to be a warrior in everything I do. And to redefine what people think of a warrior is, you know, I talk about the men and women that I served with at JSOC. And let me caveat this. This is not my autobiography or me saying, this is what I do to live the life. Everything I've learned, it's like the Isaac Newton quote. If I've seen further, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants, men and women better than me. This book is a collection of all the lessons learned. I learned from watching these warriors, which were sometimes my peers. And I'm going to be honest, I learned more from my peers in the military than the traditional hierarchy of this is my boss, driving coaching and mentorship downward. And the warriors I served with at JSOC are arguably the most lethal warriors in the world. That's just fact. It's not open to really subjective opinion. If you're arguing that, then that's more of an ego play on your part or emotion. And these warriors are not what people think they are. They're kind, they're empathetic, they're respectful. Yes, do they go into the night and do dirty things to very bad people and then come back and dial that empathy back down? But they were such amazing men and women that were, you know, husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, and just watching them not act like the lowest common denominator that you see elsewhere in the military or depicted in the military, like a tough guy or bragging about how many medals they had or how many kills they had. That didn't happen at that level. It happened at the regular SEAL teams, like where guys were counting kills, where I don't see utility in that, because we were losing the war, or medals, lying about how many medals they had. And it's funny that I go from the SEAL teams to JSOC in the level of leadership and level of performance was like a like the Grand Canyon, and one out of 40 SEALs had what it took to make the leap into that to that next level. I'm not saying that to satisfy my own ego, but it's amazing the amount of maturity that I had to quickly mature myself around guys that were older, men and women that were older than me at that command, even though I was an officer and sometimes in charge. Yeah, emotional intelligence, maturity. The bar for leadership was higher over there, and so a lot of the book and what I write about is from what I learned from those men and women and how they live their lives.
You know, not everybody has access to mentors and leaders and anybody within their circle, so it's good to have these books out there. It's like, hey, you know what? It's perfect. You read it, you listen to audiobooks, ever hear it. There's always constant information out there, and finding the right information to get there. It's perfect, man. But not only do you have the book, but you also have the podcast as well.
Yeah. And we interview a range of professionals from, you know, country and rock stars to athletes to, I just had Bernie Marcus, you know, Russian Jewish immigrant, also the founder of Home Depot his 90s. You know, the guy was a phenomenal leader. So we try to get different looks, but I do agree with you. Some of my best coaching and mentorship has come from reading. As some people say, it's leadership through readership or listening to podcasts and interesting perspectives like the Huberman Labs or something along those lines, looking at the sort of the physiological and psychological impacts of performance. So yeah, consume as much as you can and then decide what works for you and what you think is nonsense. It's fine. Even if you read a book and you take one key point away, That's a win, even if the rest of the book just didn't resonate with you.
You know, in a civilian world, you don't have as much access to training and money getting thrown your way to go to this training, education, everything. I look at everything as kind of like an infantry fighting position. Yeah, it's always had always continuous improvement, always continuously improve those fighting positions. And if the only way you could do it is through books or podcasts, through listening, through anything, you know, do it, man.
Yeah. You know, it seems like training is always the first thing to get cut during times of hardship, which I should say a down economy, when you actually should be doing the opposite. But again, it shows a lack, similar to the book you just said, a lot of people lack access to a coach or a mentor. So this is intended to give yourself a framework, a framework that you can drive on your own. And we use this concept. I don't know if you can see it up there. It's one step at a time, and doing this one step at a time. everyone today is looking for hacks and shortcuts because the demand on our time and attention has increased with the advent of technology and social media. And so people find themselves in this perpetual rut of they try this hack, they try the shortcut, it fails, and they move on to what? The next shortcut. And they just, well, hey, I'm trying something new, but yes, taking the pill that promises you to lose 30 pounds in 30 days is not going to work. And if I actually had a pill, you know, the Limitless movie pill,
yep.
I could give it to you and say, hey, if you take this, you'll be at 10% body fat overnight. Well, guess what? You'd lose it just as quick because you didn't reinforce the positive habits, the foundational building blocks that would lead to subsequent success in life. And again, self-framework, but for the organizational level, they just don't know how to coach and mentor. And they think they've got to go hire some consulting firm. And maybe you do to come in and lay the frameworks of how you create a culture of leaders creating leaders. And that we understand that so well in the military. You are expected to drive results as a platoon commander, as a company commander, as a battalion commander. If not, you'll be fired. But you're also being evaluated on whether you're creating another generation of leaders behind you. That if you as the commanding officer of an infantry battalion are taken out, that the XO will step right up as if nothing, I don't want to say nothing happened, but without, you know, a major drop in operational performance. It's in usually in the military, we've seen that. We've seen platoon commanders, we've seen platoon senior enlisted advisors get removed, and all of a sudden the squad leaders step up and everything continues to get done.
The framework, I love it, man. Mike, I appreciate you coming on the show. Everybody got to check out the Everyday Warrior, follow everything Mike's doing. And hey, you got anything else for us?
No, man. Appreciate what you do. Congrats on the impending retirement. You said 28 years of total service?
Yeah, man.
That's 8 more years than I did. And that's no small feat. And I know a lot of Americans won't understand that, but across the range of the you know, from Army Infantry to getting recalled to Iraq and your service on the federal side.
Thank you for what you did,
taking care of our, yeah. Thank you for taking care of my family, man.
No, thank you, brother. And I appreciate it.